Welcome back, everyone, to R2 Cast number 182. I made a terrible Blink-182 joke in the last episode about it, and I can't even remember how I made it to make it make sense, and arguably maybe it didn't. So if it didn't, I apologize. The last episode we had was number 181. That's why I always say that. It's how numbers work. It's not like I'm randomly jump one. It was a really fun episode, actually, because it was with Ailish Ross. Some of you might know Ailish Ross. If you're in the sheep world, you probably do. If you're in the Texel world, you definitely will. The reason I know Ailish was we went to uni together, and it was just nice after, well, making me feel old. This year is 10 years since I went to uni. So yeah, it's our big, whatever you call it, big reunion year this year. But given the fallouts we had, I doubt that'll happen. But 10 years on, it was nice to sort of see someone I hadn't seen for, apart from at Highland shows and whatnot, for 5 minutes, really not seen for a while, which was good. So that was Ailish's story there. The next episode coming up, I think it'd be fair to say today's guest knows them better than I do. Ollie Chedji is one of the year that this year presented their Nuffield findings. My understanding of Ollie's, I haven't actually filmed it yet, is looking at the ability to actually buy into farming. Are we able to buy land? Are we able to buy? Because it's an issue. I think those that follow Fed by Farmers, Cammie Wilson, Sheep Game, are following that story quite well, where Cammie's created a phenomenal business, massive credit to him. And his goal from day one, along with his partner Lizzie and now boys, is to buy. But even in the environment he has, where he has created a phenomenal product and a very fiscally sound product, shall we say, he's still not there, and it's mental how difficult it is to buy into this sector. So a very good topic there. And today is part of, again, that Nuffield cohort. You'll notice that I've brought on the full Nuffield cohort from 2024. As of last night, we filmed with Sam Watson-Jones, who was the third last of my cohort, I believe. Sorry if I'm missing anyone, but I believe there's two more left. So we're almost there, almost shared all those stories, which has been great, actually, because I hopefully will now go to Brazil knowing them all better than probably everyone else does. Although everyone now knows them all as well as I do, because I've listened to every podcast everyone's been on. But now I look back at when you joined Nuffield, and I would strongly encourage, if you have a topic, to do it. I wouldn't do it for Nuffield, I would do it for a topic. You come across this fantastic database of everyone who's ever been one everywhere, which is amazing, and as a podcaster, an absolute gold mine. So it makes it very much easy to find everyone. And today's guest, I actually watched present their final presentation at the Nuffield Concert Conference in Exeter, which was really interesting. And today's guest, who we'll get into that story later on as we go, today's guest is Toby Simpson. Toby, would you like to say hello?
Yeah, thanks very much for having me. Hi there.
Not at all, mate. Very much looking forward to this. And
just before we get started with another episode of the R2 Cast, I would like to thank our primary sponsors, Howden Rural, formerly known as A-Plan Rural. Howden are heavily involved in the social media scene in the ag space, with over 100,000 followers on Instagram. They use this following to host social media takeovers with farmers throughout the country to showcase their stories, as well as posting to their rural community blog with further articles about these people in the sector. On top of this, they like to support initiatives that are championing the British agricultural industry, such as myself. So thank you to Howden Rural for that.
And as he just said before we hit record, are you doing your eighth presentation of your findings this
It
week?
was, yeah, not including the conference, eighth today. I think I've got another couple in the next few weeks, and then there's a break. And I think a few more things coming up in the spring, summer. But but definitely part of the deal is sharing your findings. And actually, it's part of the fun that it never really ends, and you get to keep going and meeting people.
It's quite a famous term. I mean, I think maybe, God, 10 minutes in to having walked into Exeter first, walked into first the wrong building in Exeter, and then the one we all found it. Wynne had mentioned you will never now not be an ex an Nuffield scholar. You'll never be ex. You'll never be whatever, and that seems pretty clear.
Someone called it a life sentence. I won't say who, but
Well, I think, do you know what? Who says a life sentence is negative? I think it is. I mean, but I also think it's,
in a good way.
yeah. I mean, here I'm very much in my infancy. What am I, 2 months in? I haven't actually done any travel yet, but it feels like a group of people that are there to try and do better and also make you do better. It just feels positive, which is really good.
Yeah, absolutely. It's the people that make it, and you'd have found no doubt the first time you walk into that conference, it's daunting in the fact that there's a lot of, really interesting and amazing people, but actually just how welcoming the whole place is, and you can't walk for 5 meters before you bump into someone and you're chatting for another hour about something completely different and random, and you go off on tangents, and everyone's willing to, offer you ideas and introduce you to people, and it's just such a, I found, overwhelmingly welcome place.
It absolutely is, and it's quite funny. I mean, you probably had your stressful conference this year just passed. That was your
Yes.
dream. I'm very much looking forward to this year when I'll be in now and with Nuffield travel to talk about, but also no stress on myself and the ability to sort of walk in and take them sort of casually, because we didn't really see the conference because it was more hidden the new scholars away and did all the onboarding stuff and all that stuff. And I was saying to Sam Watson-Jones yesterday, I don't think I spoke to anyone for more than 10 minutes, but it's just all like there's 400 people everywhere.
Yes, and by
Bam.
the end you're just sort of ships in the night, just kind of you're almost exhausted
Oh,
of
genuinely.
with all, especially with the first day, having all that information thrown at you, and then sort of a kind of really short, sharp timetable. You don't get 5 minutes to think, so it's quite nice. And I think I found, and I'm sure you will, that it was the pre-CSE and the CSE that really you get to know everyone really well, and that's kind of what bonds you as a group, and it definitely forges you as a kind of as a Nuffielder, really, and that's that I found gave you the time to really sort of process everything.
Yeah, and I'm looking forward to that part. And you said about being knackered by the end of the day. I embarrassingly, as the youngest scholar, was in bed by about 9. My head was
Yeah.
bust. We did dinner, and I said to Yaz, I was like, "I'm so sorry. Can we just go back and lie down?"
I was also, but I had a good excuse with presenting the on the dinner night, the next day after the dinner, so I couldn't enjoy it as well.
I had a rubbish excuse, but I still done it. Just for a bit of background, Toby, we'll get into Nuffield and all that entails as we go. But could you give everyone a bit of background on just who you are, really, before Nuffield, I guess.
Sure. Well, I mean, plain and simply, an arable farmer, arable farmer's son. Grew up on a family farm in Northamptonshire. Went away to the bright lights of Leeds for university, where I did a politics degree, which was not farming related whatsoever, deliberately so. Didn't really want to be a farmer at that point. Not for any reason other than I really had my sights set on the military. So after university, I went to Sandhurst and a short service commission in the army, which I really enjoyed, but also realized wasn't necessarily a kind of quality of life with a family. So while I was young, fantastic, but by then I'd sort of really kind of had my sights set on coming back to the farm and learning the ropes while I was enthusiastic and young enough to do so, really. And so that was 2014, 15. I came back to the farm at that point, really not knowing very much kind of practical stuff. And yeah, that's sort of how I got to where I am now.
Tell us about, because I think it's one of those things that, I mean, farming's always going to be topical, isn't it? So it's probably up there. But politics is always going to be topical because everyone's going to have an agenda, personal, professional, and political. And whoever's in power is going to be right or wrong. So policy's always going to be around. And I am embarrassingly very behind on policy. It's just, I've never been interested in it. I don't even think I'm not interested in politics. And it's interesting. Tom Scrope and I had this discussion. I struggle with it, and I'll give an example. So let's say when COVID was happening, Johnson was in power. Or well, no, not true. Conservatives were in power, Johnson was the leader. And I just felt as, by the way, someone that can't say they're Labour, SNP, Conservative, because I didn't vote the last election. Please feel free to shoot me. I understand it's the main way to go. But what I hugely disliked is Johnson's doing as well or as poor as he is. Fine, grand. Let's not comment on that. Let's not make it a purely political podcast, and we can get into it if you want. It's just not my thing. But what I hated was the fact that Starmer didn't look, or Stammer, I don't know exactly how you say his name, didn't look at what Conservatives were doing and saying, well, why don't we try this for the better of the country? It was just, that's rubbish, you look rubbish. And I don't really think that matters. I think it should be, okay, that's rubbish, can we try work together instead of, I don't know, the whole party politics thing, I just think makes a complete fight out of it all. And I think that means that you never actually get to the right end. But as someone who has a degree in politics, what's your opinion on
Not, I didn't do particularly well at my degree, but it's
that?
I would, definitely agree. And I love politics. I hate politicians. I think they're incredibly boring and pointless human beings, frankly. They like you couldn't get a good answer out of them. The most interesting people, I think, are ex-politicians, because they are honest. And if you listen to interviews or read sort of about people who used to be in power, and that's the side of politics I find the most interesting, almost from a kind of analytical. I'm very quite into history, and so history and politics, and I just really sort of found that fascinating, which is why I did a degree in it. Not for the kind of political bun fighting that you see, but more the kind of just and not necessarily UK, but sort of global, just how the world works. And I just find it really fascinating. I'm a bit of a kind of geek in that sense. My favorite sort of event is election night. I love staying up and kind of watching the polls coming. It's just not because I'm cheering anyone on, but just because I just find the mechanisms of it fascinating. And then the contrast when you look at different systems in the USA, for example, completely different presidential system, and the kind of where the power lies and how that sort of is borne out. And I mean, probably in a more of a despairing way, the way that things have gone in the last few years with kind of populism and everything kind of really ramping up, which just it becomes hard to engage with. And I quite readily switch off the radio or TV when someone's just delivering a rhetorical kind of line, and it's just absolutely kind of pointless and rubbish. But get a sort of political historian on, and I'm absolutely fascinated by it. So, yeah, no, I would never ever want to enter that world at all, but just quite enjoy watching the drama.
I would just like to quickly interrupt the show for a minute to give you some extra information about our primary sponsors, Howden Rural, the new name for A Plan Rural. Howden Rural provide bespoke insurance cover for farms and estates. This could be for anything from tractors and machinery to a new exciting diversification venture. Be sure to check out Howden Rural today.
Do you see Trump getting back in?
Yeah, I do, frankly.
Yeah, so do
I
I.
do. I honestly do. Not because I have my finger on the pulse by any stretch of the
Sure.
imagination, but because actually, nothing's impossible. And frankly, by the sounds of it, the US aren't exactly faced with a kind of good alternative who's pulling out all the stops and making himself look fantastic. I think there's just real missed opportunity there, and everyone's so entrenched in the camps that they're in. I honestly don't think he could do anything that would stop people voting for him. So I would put money on it, frankly, unless something massive happened.
I made about £4,000. I well documented in podcasts before a major gambling addiction a few years ago, but don't now, luckily. But just in plays of Biden and Trump when Trump got in, just bet on back in Trump, and then he sort of went back. It was over the course of about 12 hours. I maybe turned about £800 into that, just banging about, and I really got interested because of that at the time. And then I realized my interest wasn't politics. I
No,
realized my interest was,
it's maybe
but
that probably doesn't differentiate you too much from the politicians who are also trying to run. If it's
probably, yeah, for
a
sure.
bit of a gamble, but I mean, Trump, it is a gamble if he doesn't get in, and he's facing some pretty hefty fines and prison term maybe. So.
The sort of scary thing is, I think, tier, look, I wouldn't get angry at someone for being a Trump fan. I don't get the whole not liking someone because their political stance. I wouldn't be, but the thing that blows my mind is, I think in general he would be in somewhat dangerous as a leader, but the alternative and the current president barely seems to know his name. Like, he just seems so, and he just seems like an 81-year-old man, whatever age, 82
Well,
years old.
absolutely, and
That's what I would expect of an 81, two year old.
in 4 years' time, you just and I think that's the dilemma
That's
that the
true.
electorate face, and it's there's so many other factors at play as to why they haven't put someone else up forward, and there must be, I mean, in a fairly large country of 300 and however many million people, there must be some pretty well qualified people, but unfortunately the system doesn't sort of breed that. And I'd say it's fairly sort of similar in the UK. It doesn't encourage the right people in the right place most of the time. Those that get there are by chance.
I found it quite interesting. I think I can't remember if it was on recording or off recording that I said I was in Africa in August, and I don't know how much you know about African politics. I don't know much at all, don't get me wrong, but Regis, who used to be the food and farming policy lead, I believe, in Rwanda, quite a good friend of mine now, but he spoke about Paul Kagame. And however much you know about Paul Kagame, I don't know, but basically about 6 years post genocide in Rwanda, which is 24 years ago, because it's 30 years as of it next week, the he took power and he just looked at reducing, actually eliminating, it's not eliminating, but they're doing a bloody good job of eliminating corruption. So like, let's say I'm your waiter, Toby, and I ask you for a tip. That's classed as corruption. They've like outlawed corruption to the point of like it can't happen. Now, don't get me wrong, I know it's happening, but
Yes.
we did not see it. It was hidden. Whereas in
Yeah.
Tanzania, all the time. I thought he just, everything that was written about him, everyone you spoke to just spoke well about him, but not with any fear. They weren't scared to say he was bad at this. And I found it very, very progressive.
Yeah,
Also,
absolutely.
it's not really democratic because he's been there for what, lifetime, you know? So
Yeah.
it's an interesting one. It's an interesting one, because if you're one of the folks that don't like them, then quite a rubbish 30 years for you, you know?
Yeah, and you might feel as much as one person might be very supportive, you might feel like, they stand for everything against what you think. And
Yeah.
you see that divide is borne out in so many ways in so many countries, that rural urban divide and all that sort of kind of thing. It's now being exploited by people because they realize that they can draw a line down the middle and the wedge issue, as they call it, and suddenly, that's the way it goes.
So when you did the degree, you said sort of the plan wasn't working in that sector. Was it just purely out of interest? Is that what?
No, it was purely out of interest. I wasn't ever, I never even entertained the idea. I while I was at school, I was I was sort of help out with harvest, do corn carting and things. It wasn't that I didn't actually think I would ever come back to farm, but I had my sights set on the military. I did CCF at school, which was sort of cadets really, and just love, and Duke of Edinburgh Award, so kind of just loved the outdoors, the sort of that sort of adventure side of it. As a teenager, I watched too many kind of action films and thought it'd be a great idea. So with my sights set on that, I pretty much knew that was what I was going to do. I did a school scholarship where you essentially go down to where they select for army officers. I went down for a day and a half, of which is normally a 4 or 5 day selection process. And this was when I was about 15, I think. And they basically said, "Right, what newspaper do you read? Can you dash 100 meters and dive through this window? Right, fantastic, you're in." And they give you a small bursary for school and university on the proviso you give them 4 years' service. So, that was kind of a job then sorted, really. So I was just enjoying myself.
What was the correct answer to the newspaper question?
Daily Telegraph, I believe.
I'm out then.
It's been a while, but yeah, no. So it just, I just loved it. I loved the kind of, the playing soldiers, really, and I enjoyed the challenge, and I certainly did well, through Sandhurst and in the army. I enjoyed that, being kind of in the field, in green, sort of, kind of minor leadership roles, and just having an objective, having kind of challenges thrown at you, and sort of overcoming it. And it just, yeah, I just found it really re enjoyable and rewarding. So yeah.
Pardon my complete ignorance on this topic, because aside Call of Duty, I generally have very little knowledge. It'd be a stretch to call it a simulator. What is that UK based military then? So you're not going elsewhere. You're based
Yeah,
in.
well, no, it's well, yeah, it's the British Army. We sort of finished Sandhurst and joined our regiment. So I joined the Grenadier Guards, which are infantry, so kind of your frontline soldiering. We finished our Sandhurst and platoon commanders sort of training in Wales just as the battalion was sort of on their last deployment to Afghanistan. So as much as we would have loved to have been out and joined them and done that tour, we weren't able to. So for me, that would have been the only opportunity to do overseas sort of combat, really. But yeah, there was plenty of overseas travel. We did short-term training teams where you sort of go as a group and you train a sort of small military in kind of whichever countries. There was overseas exercises and event training, and kind of very much what the sort of modern army looks like a bit today, which is just doing smaller stuff in kind of peripheral countries, really.
Excellent. And how long did you say? So 4 years from school, but working not 4 years, is that right?
No. So after university, so 4 years, 4 years
Sorry.
service, which is including the kind of year you do at Sandhurst. So it was Sandhurst for a year, 3 months at Brecon, where you sort of do the kind of green infantry soldiering. Not all the officers will go into that arm, into those arms. So we do further kind of they call it battle school, and then you join the regiment that you're going to, and Grenadiers are sort of mixture of ceremonial, outside kind of Buckingham Palace, changing the guard. We sort of joined them in the Jubilee year and the Olympic year. So based in London, absolutely fantastic. Kind of in that summer, doing lots of sort of parading and stuff. Not very much green soldiering. And then you end up sort of in charge of a platoon of around 30 guardsmen who are, relatively young, kind of away from home for the first time, and there's a lot of sort of welfare that you have to deal with on their part, and then it's just a case of planning training and doing some overseas kind of exercises, doing some bench training, and just having a good old time, really.
It's such an army to term that good old time.
Yes.
So is the again, I apologize for knowing so little of this. Is that guard the one with the hats, or is that a different guard?
Yeah,
Same
bearskin
hat.
cap. Yeah.
Okay,
So
right,
there's
yeah.
the red tunics, bearskin cap. Of which there's five regiments of foot guards. So that's where you have your Scots, Welsh, Irish guards, Coldstream guards, which is sort of more Northern England based, and then the Grenadier guards, which is kind of Southern England kind of covering. All fiercely rival, but also fiercely kind of loyal at the same time. Part of the household division, which includes the household cavalry. We'll always be involved heavily in state ceremonies, but they sort of pride themselves, rightly so, on being able to switch from that into, very kind of high standard infantry soldiers at the same time, and sort of famously kind of proud of maintaining high standards at everything that they do, and which is why I sort of quite enjoyed working in that environment. It was that the guardsmen, the soldiers were, and sort of non-commissioned officers were incredibly motivated and had a lot of sort of self-respect, really, and would always try and maintain high standards. And it was a really good ethos.
I think that sort of respect, high standard intention, and also the sort of, I guess, ability to remain calm under sort of stressful situations is a thing I've always hugely respected of military, ex-military. And it sort of stemmed from almost watching TV with my mum, where like you had a person who played that archetypical, typical sort of ex-military who's in a situation that everyone is freaking out about. And they know how to work through it, and I've always respected that hugely. It was never ever a thing I wanted to do. I don't know if that was a fear or what, but yeah, quite
It's
an amazing experience.
it's not for everyone, and actually, I think while you're young and naive, it's fantastic, and you look back in hindsight and think that was not fun. It was just we enjoyed it because we were sort of all miserable together, kind of thing.
a guy, Daniel, I believe. Who was on the podcast? He was deployed in Iraq, and he spoke about as much as he was happy to and wanted to speak about, and he said at the time you just think it's amazing, and he was like something like 42 days they went without really a brilliant shower and all this, and he remembers coming out and going for a KFC, and he was like, you remember sits back after that, and the next day he was like, I don't think I do want that. I thought it was fun because nothing stopped, but it's almost like the. I guess it's probably similar to like I've heard the is a guy called Alice Cooper, the guy that's in Kiss. He says, everyone asks him why he does drugs. And he's like, well, when you've been selling out 100,000 crowds and then you're walking around the garden with your grandson and a football, it's like a complete come down. And I assume that's kind of similar. That come down from just high octane, it can't be boring because I need to keep going, to them being like, well, is that what I want to do? And obviously, you'd always wanted to do it. Was there ever any plans, Toby, to sort of progress up the ranks in the military? You obviously had somewhat, like you said, but.
Yeah, no, well, only in the kind of the sort of the general kind of career direction that you do for that very short period of time. I think I hadn't ruled out the idea of staying in the military. And I think, but it was actually quite sort of soon after I went to university. And as much as it was fantastic, I for the first time realized how lucky I was growing up on a farm where I had, and how much I enjoyed that kind of lifestyle. Well, I say lifestyle, but you know, that environment. And it made me very quickly realize that if, you know, if I was ever going to bring up a family, I would want to do so in a similar environment. But also, you know, in terms of a challenging career, I could see myself, you know, being sort of more autonomous about how I went about my day, and you know, the challenges of farming. Not that I necessarily knew exactly how they would play out, but I kind of saw it as a big enough challenge to tempt me to go that way. So, but I think before I even set foot at Sandhurst, I knew that actually I would, as much as I always wanted to do it, as much as I still really did, I just wanted to do it to sort of prove to myself I could and you know, enjoy that adventure for the first few years. While I was in the army, actually, I was, yeah, reassured by my decision, simply because you see people who spend a lot of time away from their families for their careers, and they, you know, they do very, very well and fantastically, but it is much more of a sacrifice than I thought I would be willing to do. So, yeah, very glad to have sort of done it, but at the same time, very glad not to be doing it right now.
Did you go straight back to farm, or did I read somewhere you went on a bit of a gap year?
I between university and Sandhurst, I
Is that
travelled.
one?
I finished university in the summer, cycled to Rome with some friends, on
Oh.
a bit of a jolly, and then I went to Australia, New Zealand, South America into the autumn, and then January I started Sandhurst, so
Where?
a bit of travelling.
Yeah, where in South America?
Flew into Chile, did a lot of long bus rides up the kind of up the Atacama Desert, across to the Salt Flats, in Bolivia, up to Peru, into the jungle, and then over to Argentina, which was amazing. I went with a uni mate, and we had the most amazing kind of
Just
few months.
backpacking type thing, yeah. Just
Yeah, literally just backpacking, cheap accommodation, long, horrible bus rides around mountains with kind of, you know, bus drivers that were definitely high, and you know, 12-hour bus rides. Just thinking, just we promised ourselves if we were ever, yeah, well, when we were older, we would. When we could justify, you know, or we had jobs, we'd come back and do it all in a massive RV or something, and just do it in luxury. But it's all part of traveling, really, when you're that age.
You mentioned Bolivia. Did you go to those roads, you know, inverted commas, badly?
No, I
No.
don't think we got there. So we were on the Salt Flats, and then we went to Lake Titicaca, and then over into Peru. So I don't know. We weren't on those really hairy roads, but we were in Peru. Peruvian jungle. We went for, I think, just under a week, and kind of did a touristy sort of guide around where you sort of camp out and kind of spot some caves and stuff. But on the way back out, there had been a landslide, and it blocked off the road, and the bus drivers were just sat there, and we were sort of going, "Well, we're never going to get out of this jungle." So we sort of clambered across the landslide. It was fairly substantial, and negotiated with the bus coming the other way and said, "Well, should we just all swap over?" And the
It's a
drivers
good
were like,
idea, yeah.
"Fine." So we, you know, a few hours later, we were on our way. But it was sort of punctuated travel, as always seemed to have been punctuated by me narrowly missing disastrous events, or being on the edge of them. When I was in New Zealand, there were the earthquakes in Christchurch, which were fairly substantial. And then, yeah, there was the well, I think, as early as when I was at school doing Duke of Edinburgh, we went to Nicaragua, so Central America, climbed some volcanoes. They erupted as we were kind of just on the ferry coming off the island in the middle of the country, and Yeah, there's been many things where I've sort of gone, oh yeah, close to that, but not quite.
Am I right in saying this really random little detail? Nicaragua is one of only two countries with purple in their flag.
Sounds possible.
I'm
Would
just
be the other one.
if it's the right flag I have, it's got a wee mini rainbow
So
of
it's
a.
blue. Is it not blue and white and
It is. It's got
whatever?
a tiny, tiny rainbow
In the middle.
triangle. Yeah.
Yeah.
And there's purple on that. And along with Dominica, there's only two because purple was really expensive to make, basically, when flags were conceptualized. You know, expensive to make that color. Red was easy with blood and blue, you know, whatever.
Yeah.
Yeah, but no, that sounds amazing. I actually want to direct you in the. I'm not plugging my podcast. Well, I am, but I'm not for that reason. As you've cycled to Rome and you've done South America, a fair chunk of South America. I mean, I don't like that term actually. You can't do a continent. You can't
Not
ever.
one so large, there's many
Yeah, for
places
sure.
to go
I don't
back.
even
Yeah.
think you can do a country, and you know,
No.
unless a Tahiti or something like that. But yeah, like I had a lady on the podcast. I think it was number 163, called Kate Rawls, and Kate built a bike out of bamboo and cycled from the tip of what I believe to be Colombia all the way to Ushuaia, the bottom of Chile.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
I would, yeah, love
Yeah,
that.
it's really amazing. It's a really interesting story. So obviously the reason you and I have come into contact, Toby, is through Nuffield. I was lucky enough to be one of the probably 200 folk in attendance. I kind of unexclusive exclusive that by saying 200, didn't I? But yeah, it was the way the Nuffield conference worked was, just for those listening, I think was there 37 people presenting, I
Yeah,
believe.
close to that. Yeah, COVID
Yeah.
backlog. So we were the first year group to not quite, but almost in entirety present 2 years after we started, which was the deal going into it, that COVID was sort of on the out. There had been 2 years at least in between that had been given a kind of license to take as long as they needed, which was just something that had been done before, I think when Foot and Mouth was around. And so they had a backlog. So they had a room in which not just the year previous to ourselves, but there were subsequent before then, in which they filled with sort of the back kind of categories, and then they kept all of our year in a separate room. So I guess
Oh,
what
I
you're
didn't
alluding to
know
is
that.
you had to choose a room to visit to
Yeah,
sort of see the talks. Yeah.
absolutely. And I mean, I've got the book here. I can't actually remember. What was the guy who was doing the water capture? What was his name? That's
Tom
terrible.
Young.
Yes, yeah.
Yeah.
Not capture, but something along those lines. That
Yeah.
was in the same stage as you, wasn't it?
Yeah. He
Yeah.
was before or after me, I can't remember. Yeah.
Yeah, he's wrote it in a similar time. I'd certainly chosen to go to that one, and I'd watched yourself. And cover cropping is just not a thing. To say I'm not aware of it's completely utter lie. I just don't know much about it. And I'm aware to an extent of its benefits, but I mean the obvious benefit from a regenerative perspective. But yeah, just tell us, Toby. You've sort of come back to the farm, and like you've said, you've sort of come back really not knowing much at that point. Knew a bit from being a farmer's son, but what was the sort of process between coming back, not really knowing much, to thinking, well, this is a topic I want to travel the world and research.
Sure, it was a fair old journey. I mean, and not one intentionally followed, but it was really all down to Dad. I mean, 25 years ago, he went down the kind of soil health route, really, in an arable context where we are in Cambridgeshire, and it was one of practicality. So, kind of realizing that in ploughing every year or every sort of few years required a lot of diesel and labour, and actually was quite boring. So sort of got into what's known as min-till, so just a shallow cultivation, but also chopping straw residues, which for him was increasing organic matter. It was sort of feeding worms, and worms were good for drainage. So it was really a kind of physical means of establishment. So it meant that costs could be kept quite low in terms of fuel and labour and depreciation, and you were sort of looking after the soil as well. And he'd always been conscious of wanting to do direct drilling or no-till, as again as a kind of management practice, because it would have meant saving time and money, but had always sort of been cautious with many things that can go wrong with it. Slug pressure and managing residues and black rust becoming a problem. And so I kind of came back 15-ish years into that journey, very naively, saying, well, "Why you keep speaking about this no-till and this kind of conservation agriculture? Like, why don't we just do it?" And it was really all credit to Dad for sort of going, "Well, go on then, try it." Not saying it wouldn't work at all, but he'd been hesitant. He had the kind of experience to sort of be cautious. I had the naivety to be foolish. And I guess together we could kind of go into it and make some mistakes and find out what was going to work. And I'd sort of, I did a postgrad course at Cirencester after I left the army, well, I say part time, it was full time, but I was back on the farm every few days anyway. And just the exposure to sort of that and a few people, I was sort of going, well, there's cover cropping too. I think that's part of this kind of no-till journey and practice. And Dad wasn't dismissive of it, but sort of had never necessarily seen the benefit to it because it was a cost. It didn't provide you with a kind of bottom line necessarily that you could put on the gross margin. And we had weeds growing in the field where they were as good as a cover crop. So it was that was the sort of state of things, 2018, 19. I had to learn just how the farm worked anyway. So I spent most of the time working out which way to put the key into a tractor and how you kind of just made anything work. And that was a challenge, for me. And not only that, but Dad was very ready to sort of hand over kind of a lot of the office and the admin and the planning on the farm, which again I was really lucky to be able to do. A lot of people are sort of kept at bay really from those decisions. But because my grandfather, his father, had been really generous in letting Dad get on with it, having his head, Dad was more than ready to let me do the same with kind of good backup. So I had a lot to kind of baptism of fire really. And the first year we sort of tried direct drilling, it kind of went well and went poorly for different reasons. And I think it was really down to the weather. It was a really wet autumn of 2019. But where we drilled into sort of a catch crop or a cover crop, it was notably better. It built, in the autumn, it had built us some resilience in travelling on the sort of wetter ground. The slugs, which would have normally eaten the wheat that we planted, actually ate the sort of green cover of the oilseed rape that had volunteered to grow. And so it kind of, and I started to do a lot of reading about it, and I started to go, well, actually, there's something in this, and I don't quite know what. And we tried in this an overwinter cover crop, so before a spring crop, and again, we tried different termination timings, and I found that actually, where I had drilled it in the green, like I had in the autumn, it had the direct opposite effect, and it inhibited the barley growing, probably in hindsight due to the what's known as allelopathic effect of the plants dying down and releasing allelochemicals in the soil, which inhibit the crop to grow, which is a kind of weed suppressive effect, but it was also crop suppressive. And so it was at that point I was going, well, how on earth are we going to make this work? And almost not trying to go out and prove a point to say that it would work, but almost to say, well, there's a lot of well-known stuff kind of out there, a lot of well-known people who do it very successfully. So I kind of went out, sort of went, well, actually, I'd love to make this work in our context on our farm, which Dad would sort of was hesitant to do. And I stumbled into Nuffield in a way. I knew a little bit about it, but I didn't really. I'd read some reports on some of the things we were doing. We were growing intercrops and looking at no-till. And one must have been January 21. COVID, kind of middle of COVID lockdown. I think we had just had our second child, and everything was just kind of chaos. And I was, enjoying a whiskey and sat by the fire, and I was re looking for an old Nuffield report on cover cropping or something that might point me to what some answers might be. And realised that there was some really great stuff out there on intercropping, no-tilling, kind of regenerative farming. There were some old reports on sort of green manuring and stuff, but certainly UK wise, there wasn't like a pure cover crop
Okay.
report. I suddenly thought, well, why not?
Look, yeah, exactly. And to be fair, you have a slightly a different opinion of hectic to me, because hectic to me is not with a whiskey by the fire. That sounds pretty calming. No, for sure, for sure.
Yes, well, it was anything that would calm me down.
Yeah, tell us, Toby, about Nuffield. Tell us about your travels and where you went and what you found.
So I really kind of set out to look at like two sides of it, really, the practical side, but also what opportunities came out of it. So how we would make it work in our soil on our farm, but also what wider opportunities there were, looking at kind of integrating livestock or kind of public engagement and sort of the wider benefits to the system. Due to kind of time and sort of money rest sort of restraints, it was very much I had to be quite specific about where I went, for any length of time. So I sort of stuck to kind of the northern hemisphere, roughly UK specific climate and soil types as much as possible. I thought I'd go quite far north and see sort of a really short growing season, and yeah, sort of down into France as well, and kind of parts of Europe, just to see where they have a bit better of an opportunity. So I did sort of Scandinavia, Northern Europe, UK, North America, USA, Canada, which was fantastic. I sort of broke it down into several week kind of excursions into Europe, there back, and then I went over to USA, Canada for sort of one kind of big trip, so to speak. And then I put something out on Twitter, just saying, anyone in the UK who's got doing cover cropping, I'd love to come and pick your brains. And I had, honestly, the amount of people who, farmers love talking about farming, and I sort of must have had 40 or 50 responses, and I just got a map, put a dot on roughly where I thought they were or where they said they were. And I couldn't get around to everyone, sadly, but I got around to quite a few, and I just drew big circles. And I'm like, right, I could go for 2 or 3 days, see, three or four, two or three people a day, move on. And I sort of did that, and I found really actually in the UK a lot of the sort of real pioneering farmers were there.
It's funny you say that farmers like talking about farming. You take anyone to a party or a club, they want to talk about their a different thing, their hobby, their whatever. Farmers are like cows, barley.
And it's and amazing, people have the same problems, challenges, no matter where they are, and you can very quickly find common ground, when you're traveling. And for farmers, it always comes back to the weather, price, kind of, being the challenge, really.
I hope you've kicked your feet up and got comfy and enjoying another fantastic episode of the R2 Cast with another really interesting guest. I would just like to quickly take another second to plug the sponsors of the show today, The Scottish Farmer, and I would strongly advise you to go out and pick one up this week and see even more of the fantastic people that are in our industry.
One thing that, and you're the first, you're actually not the first scholar that I've interviewed, Toby, that's done their scholarship before, but you're the first scholar I've interviewed since I've known more about Nuffield. I've always been aware of it, but like I've interviewed like Anna Jones and my God, I've even thought of it. I know there's five or six that I have interviewed, but I just at the time I wasn't involved in Nuffield myself. And it seems to be everyone says they have a moment where something changed. They suddenly realize something. Did you have one of those moments?
It was constant. It's hard to explain. It was really, I mean, I really do rate my experience. And I think that was all down to I was just in the right place me mentally to want to learn. And so I kind of needed it. I was hungry to sort of discover things. And I guess going at it with a real open mind just made me kind of really take in a lot more than just sort of going out to look at one thing and being reductionist about it. And so what I found was, I kind of, not necessarily every single meet, but generally there, every sort of few meets or so, I would just be sort of mind blown in a way, not through sort of one obvious realization, but just in kind of seeing the sort of physical results of something over time, or someone doing something differently. And I found what was so useful, and probably one of the kind of underrated parts of traveling with Nuffield, was actually the time traveling in between places, because it gave me so much time to process and think about what I'd seen. Especially in America, long drives, or I kind of got trains about Europe a bit, and you can just almost switch off from work, from life. You've got something in your head, you can process it. I found it really useful just writing down every night just to sort of journal about the meet I've done. So I didn't necessarily take notes while I was meeting someone. I took photos and then I just sat down, with a beer in the evening and just wrote up my thoughts. And I can't was constantly just my thought process was evolving. And I kind of wanted to go down different routes, and I was sort of not seeing answers necessarily, but just seeing kind of this bigger picture. And I think the real big penny drop, if you like, was one of my last visits in America. I went to see David Brant in Ohio, and he's a real pioneer out there. And he sadly passed away a few weeks after I visited him. But it was there where he'd been doing all this stuff that I'd been seeing along the road. In Europe, people have been doing it for 10, 15, 20 years sometimes. He had been doing it for 50 years.
Wow.
And it blew my mind how simple it was. There was nothing really kind of complicated. Some people would kind of maybe think it might need to be. He wasn't using any special technology, any special kind of inputs. It was just really simple basics done well over a long period of time. And he we didn't it, I didn't have to see any kind of thing other than the soil. We dug this hole, and it just said it all. It really, really did. When I knew how much rain they've just had before, you feel it, you smell it, you see it, and you suddenly go, yeah, that's it. It's that simple. It is just look, from an arable perspective, just from any farming perspective, looking after your soil, growing cover crops, not overkilling it with tillage if you don't need to, not overusing pesticides and fertilizers, but using a bit, using what it needed. It just was that continual process. And so coming away from that, it almost was the perfect culmination of seeing lots of great things happening and then just seeing one thing that had been happening for so long, you realize this is all in the right direction. It just takes time.
So when you were talking about that soil that you were saying, this is it, were you seeing a lot of worms? What were you seeing in color? What are you talking there?
Everything really. I mean, it was structure. So, they say if it looks like chocolate cake, and it really did. And I guess in North America, there's some pretty poor soils, much lower organic matter than we would have. And his soil was more like our soil here, higher organic. I say ours. In the UK, generally we have higher organic matter. And over there they can be sort of 0.1 to 0.5, and that's where he started. And he was up at 8. And the NRCS had reclassified his soil, and he had these cores on his wall, which literally went from, sand color to black chocolate cake over decades, and it, and yeah, so yeah, it was seeing it. And to me, that is the sort of sign of where I want to be with our soil. It's a functional soil that requires very little intervention. It can do everything for you. It can maintain a good output. You're not robbing from it. You're feeding it. You're looking after it. And it's that soil cycle which is so important. And he doesn't need any more organic matter, but he's just feeding and cycling it. And then that organic matter is feeding his microbes, and his microbes are feeding his crops. And it's that process of realizing it's all just part of an energy sort of input food chain, really.
Have you come back now, having travelled and changed things at home? Or I know it's not a change that you do like that, but a sort of implementation program, if you will, across the course of a few years.
Yeah, definitely. There's so many kind of little things I picked up. Whether they'll work or not, I don't know. But for me, just planting more plants, more diversity in our sort of cover crop mixes. Not trying to kind of when I set out, I'd probably be scrimping on a mix. I'd see how low I could keep the cost, just cost of everything. And now I sort of see it as part of kind of the much bigger picture. And actually, if I can get a really fantastic sort of rooting system growing over the winter, or even as a catch crop just in the autumn, I might not see a hundred, I might not see all the benefits in the first year or the second, but actually 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 10 years down the line, if I sort of really kind of keep looking after it, it'll start paying me back in my cost savings in the business. So if I'm putting on fractions less fertilizer on my wheat, and yet getting a similar output, then I haven't spent the money on that. And it's the same with fungicides and insecticides and herbicides. And if I can find ways to sort of make those savings, so it's a move to kind of more of a hybrid system rather than being conventionally high input, putting on the kitchen sink, which frankly isn't sustainable anymore, not with prices doing what they're doing, but also not with the soils doing what they're doing. And so if we can find that sweet spot where we're kind of moving the dial, we're moving to essentially a more organic system without using tillage. I don't know how far we'll go or how far we'll get, but it's given me kind of clear objectives in those reductions, so to speak, and then some different tools to experiment with to find out ways to get there.
Just sort of slightly off topic for a second there. What are the biggest challenges you're finding at home? Do you have any issues with like flea beetles with oilseed rape, or
Yeah.
what are the biggest challenges at the minute?
Yeah, no, usually this is the first year we haven't grown it in a very long time. We had a fantastic looking crop last year, and we'd beaten the slugs, we'd beaten the sort of the rain. We got the oilseed rape away. It beat the pigeons, it beat the kerosene flea beetle, and it looked fantastic. And we hadn't really spent too much on it, fortunately, but over winter something called rape winter stem weevil had reared its head, and we'd never heard of it really, and it burrowed into the stems, and the frost essentially wiped out 75% of the crop, and it looked fantastic. So
Rape winter stem weevil, did you say?
yeah, it was suddenly something else they decided that was gonna want to
Yeah,
eat our rape. So it became too I really kind of like to look at it from risk. It became too risky, and it's, I view the same as spending money on a crop. It can be risky if you're not going to get anything back. So for challenges, we are in the east. We're quite dry. We're on heavy soils. They can bake out when they're in the summer. They're also quite wet over the winter. So our limiting factor is often moisture. The last few years, the weather pattern has been such that it doesn't really rain between the spring planting, spring drilling, and harvest. We get nowhere near enough, and that's the thing that's limiting our yields to some extent. So if we can improve our organic matter, if we can improve moisture retention in the soils, we'll hold on to all this rain that we're getting now that's just sort of slopping away. But so they're the challenges. I think it's typical of any arable farming operation. We've got rent finance to pay, families that they've kind of need to make a living off the farm. We've got fixed costs. The variable costs are sort of ramping up, and we don't know what we're going to sell the wheat for at the end of harvest.
How many people do you have working on the farm?
One full time, and so it's dad and I. Mum's in the office doing the books, and dad spends most of his time either on the combine or he's doing building projects or kind of track maintenance, all the kind of the stuff that my 3-year-old son absolutely loves watching him do, which is anything to do with a digger. I sit kind of between tractor and office in planning and selling, and then Joe, who works for us full time, is great because he can hop on the drill, hop on the sprayer, hop on the loader, and do everything in between. So we kind of just make it work.
Excellent, excellent. No, here's it, you know, I've really enjoyed it actually, Toby, because like I've interviewed so many people now that are, I'm like, well, I can't wait to see your travels. I can't wait to see what's happening. And now, obviously, I'm going to be doing those travels and watching my bunch do it. But it's really cool to sort of see what it's like just being on the other side, like what it'll be like in 2 years' time for me. I'm actually quite lucky that I'll be presenting in Scotland, which is quite nice, unless I somehow don't manage. Yeah, I'll be presenting in Aberdeen, which is nice. No, it's been great to chat. It's a great topic, really good topic, and a topic that I think it would be fair to say to me doesn't make sense, but it feels like the right thing to do. It feels like it just when I say it doesn't make sense, I mean basically before we had a chat and when I have tried to understand cover cropping. There's just something that I just seem to be missing. I can't fully put my finger on it, but it just seems to work. It seems to make sense. It seems to work into, I think when people say regenerative farming, you're like, well, what do you mean? And I think this is what we mean. I think is, well, a massive part of it in my head.
Yeah, I mean the way I see it is, and kind of it's essentially the soil is a living, breathing organism. There's microbes upon microbes within it, and they thrive off plant roots and plant residues, and it's that energy process. So it's carbon and kind of sugars into the soil. through photosynthesis, which feeds bacteria and fungi. They're eaten, they're eaten, they're eaten. And as they die, they release nutrients that they've kind of been eating, and then they provide them to the plants that you're trying to grow as well. So it's just this kind of this cycle. So if we're just planting something and then using something artificial like fertilizer to grow it, we're skipping a process really. But if we can grow as much of that green kind of matter and residue as we can, we're just feeding a hungry soil, and it's these microbes that become organic matter in the long term.
Yeah, and it's probably a hungry soil that for knocking on decades now, we in general have been maybe not feeding enough and more just taking from. No, a very interesting topic. Very interesting topic. And yeah, I can't exactly say I look forward to your travels. You've done them, but yeah, just look forward to sort of following and seeing where things happen over the coming years. And I'm sure we'll be bumping into each other at various Nuffield conferences in the future.
No, absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah. However, before I let anyone go, there's two questions I ask everyone that come on the podcast. The first one is, where do you see yourself in 5 years? And the second is, if you had any advice for people coming into farming, what would they be? What would it be?
5 years, I will, well, hopefully be wiser, but probably none the wiser. Is more reality. But as long as I'm enjoying what I'm doing, that's the most important thing. It's really all about the journey, not the destination. So where I've got to, I don't know. I've got a few ideas, like I say, within the business where I'd like to be. But actually, as long as I've enjoyed what I'm doing to get there, then it's been right. And for anyone coming into farming, I think, I mean, yeah, I mean, we've said it a lot, look after your soil. That's probably the most important principle of any farm system. But I'd say, coming with an open mind, ready to learn, and if someone tells you it can't be done, prove them wrong,
I love that. I love it.
because you can do it, and if you want to make it work, you'll make it work.
It's such a weird thing. I don't think I've ever told someone they can't do something. I just don't get the mentality behind it. I really don't get it.
But there's a lot of it in farming, whether
Yeah.
you're saying you
Yeah.
can't do it or it can't be done or that'll never work. There's a lot of sort of sucking through teeth, kind of looking over the hedge or looking over the fence and going, and that really inhibits kind of innovation. And I saw it a lot in America where people were put off, because they didn't want to be ostracized, and it's just so wrong.
Yeah, I completely agree. And here, if you do try a thing, it doesn't work, who cares?
Yeah, you'll learn.
Yeah, exactly. Let's go try the other things. No, pleasure having you on, Toby. Appreciate your time.
Not at all. No,
Yeah.
well, best of luck with your travels. I'm very jealous of your CSC, and I'll be seeing you at all the conferences.
Yeah, I do feel somewhat bad talking to your cohort about our
Yeah,
CSC, I must say. But no, been a pleasure. Thank you for coming on. For those of you listening, I hope you've enjoyed Toby's story there. I've tried not to cough too much throughout. I've actually been coughing quite a bit. Toby will see this, but I keep muting myself. You just haven't heard it. So yeah, last episode was with Ailish Ross. We spoke about Tupp Semen Collection. We spoke about Marketing Textile Society. A lot going on there, which is really good. Next one is with Ollie Chedji, speaking about I think his topic was called Living the Farming Ladder, I think was what the topic is. That right, Toby? Living.
Living the farming ladder. Yeah.
Yeah, a coin, well, a term coined, I believe, by Michael Blanch.
Yeah.
Another Nuffield scholar who I have had on the podcast and couldn't remember when I said earlier. And the next episode's actually quite an interesting one as well. Well, I say that as if the rest aren't. For those of you that follow the All In series, we've obviously had footballers who've won the European Cup. We've had the world record holder for the first person to go to every country in the world twice. A maniac. We've had a lot of different folk on there, some really interesting folks, just the only real being no attachment to food and farming. And the episode coming up is the Scottish geologist. So Louisa Hendry has an Instagram account with about 300,000 followers, just talking about rocks. So yeah, I look forward to rock and roll for number 184. That was the worst one yet. So yeah, see you in the next episode, Ollie Chedji. That's been Toby Simpson, and we shall see you all for number 183. See you then.
I hope you've enjoyed another excellent episode of the R2Cast as much as I have, and I would just like to quickly thank our primary sponsors of the show today, Howden Rural, the new name for A-Plan Rural. If you follow Howden Rural on social media, you'll see the plethora of work that they do to support this sector, and it's been a pleasure to work alongside them so far, and long may it continue. For more information about them, be sure to check out howdeninsurance.co.uk/rural. And I'll see you for the next episode.